University.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another discussion here with A. Walrus. Today he would like to speak about the undemocratic future and how we all kind of need to get used to this idea. Fascinated to know what he's going to say. But before we get going, want to know all about politics. I do have a course called Foundations of Politics, kind of goes along with the Populist Illusion, many other great courses, Foundations of Economics, Shakespeare, bestseller is The Trivium. Walrus, where can people find you?
You can find me here on YouTube with the same name, or search for The Longhouse, our weekly show. You can also find me on Twitter, same name, or at Walrus in a Suit, in one word.
And, okay, so the undemocratic future.
Yes.
What do you mean by this, and how do you unpack it?
It's a bit of a, yeah, it's a bit of a, you know, flair, I guess, to spin it like that. I think if anyone is listening to this video and haven't listened to the things we already have talked about, I would definitely recommend the other two videos first for sort of the total context, because it's sort of with these two conversations in mind I think about this. And I also, just by the nature of being from Europe, is thinking about this sort of in the frame of Europe. So this might be different where you live, and you might listen to this and think this is insane, or maybe you're also living in Europe and you're thinking this is okay. So
to be clear, the undemocratic future of Europe.
I guess, but you can let me know if you think this would apply elsewhere. So we talked about the falling birth rates. We talked about, you know, how the reign of quantity has really, you know, taken its hold. And we discussed how the 20th century, or especially, you know, post-World War II, has been an era of extreme surplus, and an unprecedented era that is most likely coming to an end. And the reality is that democracy thrives on material surplus, being a system of quantity. But it's not good in eras of scarcity, because democracy, boiling it down, is just redistribution of gains. Mm-hmm. So what we're looking at is probably, as we discussed, demographic decline as a sort of consequence of that, resource constraints, maybe even, and you know, I know this is controversial, but climate pressures, right? We're looking at crisis with pensions and the boomers. Overall, the pie is shrinking. So democratic argument is essentially a luxury of a civilization when we're all tightening the belt. So the primary duty of a democratic state, or European democratic state, will naturally become not about distributing that surplus, but managing the scarcity. Mm-hmm. And so this is where things get a bit strange, because the way I see it right now, the let's call it the European right wing, or the right wing populist, especially on Twitter, whatever you want to call the right, is not really prepared to deal with this. We've talked about them being ideological rather than pragmatic. We talked about them sort of being populist as a function of democracy. Having people vote for you to do things that is going to damage them is not a sustainable model. So my sort of, if you're going to want like the big idea thesis, I'm saying that the future of Europe is undemocratic, in the sense that my vote will not necessarily dictate what my country does. That doesn't mean that it's going to be authoritarian in a crude sense. It doesn't mean that it necessarily has to be tyrannical or violently imposed. It might not even mean It might mean, but it might not mean the end of elections or parliaments. But it means that the problems ahead of us cannot be solved with short-term electoral thinking, and social media causing an ideological fracture in society or in the population makes a consensus impossible. And especially in Europe, where consensus and ethnicity is so tightly coupled together, that it's very dangerous, in my opinion. Because, I mean, you can look at Yugoslavia, etc., to see how little ideology is required to basically cause brother wars, as it were. So the reconciliation here is going to have to be quite decisive, which means that governance has to be insulated from the whims of the crowd for the next, let's say, 100 years at least. That's sort of the big picture take here, is that we're heading for quote unquote undemocracy, and keep fighting it is essentially, you actually beat me to this with your Substack like 2 days ago. Fighting this instead of acknowledging it and trying to look for, in my opinion, competency rather than ideology, is accepting the matrix instead of trying to fight for something better.
Yeah, I mean, I've had this view for a long time because, I wrote this book, Populist Illusion, that said, democracy is an illusion, blah, 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 blah. There is a permanent bureaucracy, a permanent ruling class, a deep state, etc. But then, as time has gone on, I've kind of realized that there are certain figures in the system. I like to talk about Tony Blair, right? But he's not the only one. We kind of figured this out a long time ago.
I wasn't going to say him, but you said him first, so
I mean, well, if you read his book on leadership,
Oh
like
yeah, I had
everything
it.
you
Yeah.
like everything you just said there, he basically like he basically says, yeah, I mean, all
If you
like we
read
need.
between the lines in the book or in his interviews, when he talks about this, you can tell that what he's saying is this is going to be painful. This is going to hurt. Whatever's coming, right? And it's I guess my disagreement is just that I kind of disagree a little bit with Tony Blair on the destination, but that doesn't mean that he's wrong on the mechanics.
Well, I mean, what he's saying is, look, we need to compete with China, to compete with everyone else. We need a 20, 30, 50-year planning time horizon. And because the situation's urgent, we cannot mess about with the flim-flam of nonsense politics, basically. And I mean, he is a little bit instrumental when it comes to a lot of, I mean, over COVID, he was basically insane. He was like, I mean, he was actually advocating for a kind of anointed versus benighted, vaccinated versus unvaccinated. Like, he was actually advocating for special privileges being granted to the vaccinated and locking the unvaccinated out of civilized society, right? That's where his mind was at that time. So, I mean, I do see the dangers, right? As kind of a little bit
Sure,
insane
certainly.
of this kind of runaway technocracy, you could say. But on the other hand, there are genuine problems of governance, basic governance, that if we're going to have functioning countries, they need to get a hold of. For example, like at the moment in this country, they've been talking about banning social media for under 16s. Okay. And a lot of people have said, well, this is a round the back door way of getting age verification snuck onto the internet. Okay.
Sure.
It's kind of like a digital ID by stealth. But the reason that these technocrats like Blair are obsessed with trying to get this online is because they know if they don't do it, they're going to have a severe kind of society-wide issue on their hands in a few years' time. It's gonna lead to chaos, essentially, if they can't get a grip
And
on,
that's the
because
sort of the
go on.
weird thing. You end up arguing for the technocrats against the right because they don't see it themselves. I mentioned going to the Schillings event in Germany a year ago, I said on stage that I'm for banning Twitter X in Europe. And I got a lot of pushback for that.
I said that in my
But I,
article just 2 days ago. Yeah.
yeah, I know. And the reason I'm for it is because I would rather have a unified population that has to work with the center left than trying to move the populist right towards reason, essentially. That's a simpler problem to have, essentially. And it's very difficult to sort of reconcile that. But I think that's also the most important part of this. If I could, I would put, in parentheses for this video is that yes, the undemocratic future and the right needs to adapt because this is going to happen by necessity, whether you like it or not. And you know, going back to our previous conversation, you as a right winger hammering on about the birth rate isn't, it's just not relevant. It's just and having culture war victories doesn't produce policy outcome, and you cannot satisfy your base's desires. So again, this weird sort of situation arises where actually technocratic competence is a better selector within, I'm going to use a shorthand here and say Western society is actually better than finding people who are on the right. And you see this happening in Denmark a little bit. Someone would probably say, I forget his name on Twitter, Drogba Cunley, I think is his name. Would joke about this, saying that it's the Nordic autism that makes us inevitably incapable of ignoring numbers. But I think Denmark is just early when it comes to saying that actually, you know what, this immigration thing isn't really working. We're just not, we're hemorrhaging money. We have to do something. And the reality is that, in my opinion, the reality is that we're gonna get remigration. We're just gonna have to also accept the pride flag.
Well, I mean, I think the poster boy for this at the minute is Mark Carney. He's calling it values-based realism, but I mean, when I talk to Black Horse, Mark Carney's got Canada into negative net migration. He's doing some deportations. He gave that extraordinary speech at Davos the other day. He's doing the Blair thing. He's doing the technocratic competence, quiet, sophisticated, standing up to American belligerents as well, which has looked increasingly brutish and cartoonish and so on. And I find it, I look at his what I call the football manager stats, and Carney is starting to look closer to the kind of sensible centered leader that I prefer to see than.
Right.
I look here. I mean, Nigel Farage and all these kind of clowns. I'm at
Yes.
the point where I take the Starmer. Honestly, I mean, just today now, just today, Starmer's gone to China, right? He is trying to do the Carney thing. Starmer is. He's gone to China to try to, negotiate some trade deals or something to have, so we're not basically over a barrel with the Americans all the time. Okay, just like Mark Carney went over to China, Starmer's like the first prime minister in 8 years to go over to China. This has caused a massive reaction with the head banging right about, Chinese security, they're going to spy on us, human rights record, all these different things, the loony left, we should see China as a foe, our real friends are America, all this sort of stuff. All coming from both the Tory right and reform types and people like that. Whereas realistically, any leader of Britain at this time has to be exploring their options. I mean, whoever the Prime Minister was, I'd expect them to have a trip to China. Do you know what I mean? This is like operating in the current reality of the modern world. But, you know, the reaction is hysterical from the conservatives.
So. Right. And, you know, I call it the, if we're going to play, play Hearts of Iron 4 for a moment, I call it not the new European sort of like Caesar, but rather, you know, if you could design your own ruler, I would design the European Lee Kuan Yew, essentially. Someone who's able to operate on, and that's the thing about sort of like post-truth world as well, is that you have to operate on multiple levels at once, and you have to be comfortable with contradicting yourself constantly. Someone who's able to hold the two sort of thoughts in their head simultaneously, that you have a philosophical understanding of where you are. We've talked about reign of quantity. We've talked about birth rates, you know, modernity has fallen, all of that. And understand that democracy cannot solve our problems. And then you have sort of like level two, or a level below, is the practical responsibility, wrangling the technocratic state and being able to wield practical power for practical solutions, sort of prioritizing long-term solutions for your people's health, you know, managing population decline is way better than pretending that it's not happening, right? And understanding that the perfect is the enemy of the functional. So if you're able to sort of operate on those two modes of being at the same time as a politician, I think you can do a lot of good. The question is, I don't know if there's anyone who's able to do that. I was hoping when Starmer started doing, you know, undemocratic stuff, that he was actually going to do it, that he was going to start just doing things and drag everyone kicking and screaming. But it seems like he chickens out at like the last moment or something.
Yeah, unfortunately, and, there's Taco and there's Sacco. Sacco is Starmer always chickens out, or Starmer. I mean, he's Starmer always U-turns. He doesn't have the courage to go full Tony, right? He doesn't have the courage to do it. He always cucks out, you know, backs down because some leftist somewhere is complaining, or you know, he cucks out of other things as well. He's scared of the right for some reason. You know, I mean, I was joking on Twitter, but they've just announced reform. This guy, Matt Goodwin, is going to be a reform MP. I just tweeted out, Keir Starmer should just arrest him. Right? Because that is like that image of Starmer, right? Of there's a kind of like Stalinist, insane dictator. But he never does it. Like he never followed. Like I remember during Biden's era, I used to listen, you know, I've always, you know, kept an ear on Dickie Spencer, who in some ways came to many of these conclusions like years before anyone else.
And
Spencer was always frustrated that the Democrats didn't actually follow through. Like they weren't ever serious. They didn't actually, you know, put Trump in jail, or they just never actually followed through when push came to shove. You know, for some reason Trump ended up having plot armor, or Biden would cuck out, or whatever else. So it's like, how can I say, like there's this weird thing where, yeah, the right are constantly blue-balled by these charlatan populists who aren't serious, who constantly, you know, talk a big game, but then don't actually do the things that they promise they're going to do. But in a strange way, if you're a left-winger, if you're a member of BlueAnon, you're constantly blue-balled and cucked out as well, because they never like, do you know what I mean? They always
just Yeah, they do. I'm not sure if it's just, it just becomes a property of the democratic system that, you know, at some point you just hit a physical or practical wall where the thing you want to do just isn't possible without you having so much political power that it wouldn't have mattered anyway. But then you're suggesting revolution, which I don't think is going to happen. I think for much of Europe, I mentioned Ruk Bakanli on Twitter. He has something he tongue in cheek in a way calls basically finism. Is looking at these problems and saying that actually, you know what, we can just sort of fix a little bit here, a little bit there, and things are going to be basically fine if you live in Europe. We'll do remigration and we'll keep the pride flags, and things are going to be good, right? That's it. Now that's a very hopeful message, but that also accepts sort of the clunky mechanisms of democracy, and especially on continental Europe, where we don't have the two-party systems. Things are a lot more messy here. A lot more backdoor deals, a lot more opportunities for long-term thinking, I feel, than in the two-party system of Britain. But I'm not too familiar with it. I don't know what you think.
I mean, another thing that I have thought, and I mean, this has become a little bit, Trump has made it much more difficult, I think, in with his belligerence in the past couple of weeks. I think he's done tremendous damage actually to right-wing populist parties in Europe, and here as well. Reform of they were, I think many people are saying they passed their peak. That's partly because they've taken in a ton of Tories in the past couple of days, but it's also partly a result of how much capital was sewn up, sucking up to Trump, right, from right-wing populist leaders. And when Trump turns around and insults like British troops who served in, I mean, I think he's apologized for that. I think actually King Charles wrote to him to say, like, hold on a second, 280,000 Brits served in Iraq and Afghanistan. How dare you say this sort
Jesus.
of thing,
Yeah.
right? And he did apologize for it, but the fact is the damage is already done, right? He kind of but when he's been as belligerent as he has, it then it, in a strange way, has strengthened the neoliberal center, and it has made the kind of populists, I mean, they've had to fall in line in a way. Le Pen fell behind Macron, and even Farage in this country was like, oh, steady on, Donald, and so in a way he it the American European split in a way is discrediting populists or discrediting populism. But the I think there's something more substantial behind it, which is that as time has gone on, I have come to see the populist parties in Europe and in this country almost as a kind of American operation or American Israeli operation at the very least, to try to kind of create this world of, they used to call it globalism versus nationalism. When you study the geopolitical reality, it's like, well, nationalism may be good if you're America, desperate to cling on to an empire and with some, expansionist pretensions or something like this. But if you're Europe in the present world, being isolated little nations, probably not a good idea. It's pretty
No, it's
like
not.
it's just not it's like not a good idea. Some sort of federalism or European Union or something like this to stand up to China, to stand up to Russia, to stand up to America is obviously in its geostrategic interest. So, I mean, and as Trump has kind of forced the issue, I think it's made that reality more stark, even for many right wingers in Europe. I hesitate to say right wingers in this country because we had Brexit here, and our right wing is insane, as you know. So, they're kind of basically like quasi American at this point, basically like an arm of MAGA at this point.
Yeah,
So.
I've seen British people call for Trump to like invade Britain at this point. Respectable British, right wingers. I'm not going to name any names, but yeah, people that I thought were tuned into these things seem to have sort of
One
drunk
of them
the
was in,
Kool-Aid
no,
quite
one of them
deeply.
was in the Daily Mail, like an actual journal, like a guy called Richard Littlejohn ran that as an article in the Daily Mail. So it's not just online commentators, but mainstream journalists have said stuff like this as
Insanity.
well. But anyway, go on.
Sorry, we were talking about the EU. Yes, yeah, that's the thing, because you mentioned the EU, and then it's all because Twitter is horrible, and even Even YouTube is a horrible place to have these kind of discussions in the comment section, because it's all going to be, regulations and bottle caps and all that stuff. But I see it in the way that Europe has a number of issues. Europe and the EU has a number of technocratic policy issues that need to be solved. If you look at, for example, America and China, they have civilizational issues that are quite more sort of stark than ours. So that's why I'm always sort of like confused at people online who keep sort of like banging on the EU for, oh, but you don't elect your politicians in the EU, or oh, you're regulating too hard, or things like that. Yes, there are things to criticize, but I'm still living in a 95%, white majority country.
And the
I don't
EU
know.
leadership is very noticeably very white as well, unlike the
Yes.
Tory Party or Reform or
And
MAGA or
yes,
something else.
sometimes they get on weird ideological bents about, green policy. But then also, when the car companies say, "Hey, this is unsustainable," we change it. And it is possible to navigate this. I'm not saying it's sort of going to happen, right now, or if it's going to be the same people in charge. I'm just saying, again, if I were to bet on anyone in this race, I'm betting on myself.
What do you think about all the bet? There's a lot of stuff like Europe is weak, because if you watch channels like Duran and things like that, you kind of get it from both angles. So there's the kind of Russian angle: Europe is weak, Europe is divided, they can't do this thing, because really what they've got in mind is Ukraine. But then you also get it from the American side: Europe is weak, Europe is cut, blah blah
Yeah.
blah. And you must see a lot of this sort of rhetoric, if you're paying
I
attention
see a
to
lot
it.
of it. Yeah.
It's up and down your Twitter timeline all day, every day. There's been many different iterations of it. What's your response, or what's your kind of thought when people say, well, Europe is weak, Europe is cut, you're going to have Sharia law, blah, 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 all these talking points? What's your response?
Well, I mean, I said one of them already is that I live in a, majority white country. What about you, Mr. American? I think they're at 52% or something now, while most European countries are at well above 75, if we're going to talk about immigration and Sharia. The other thing, not to sound like a total libtard, but this is just the truth, is that a lot of Americans you see online are either who talk this are provenly either bots or have been poisoned by a Russian intelligence operation that is quite more sophisticated than we ever believed. The Russians have been on this for quite a long time. They're good at what they do. They're 10 years ahead of us. I think a lot of regular people who have, to go back to our first talk, who have gained access to information they have no right to know as some sort of like warfare weapon, they have been given information that they have no business knowing. And then they interpret it wrong, and what comes out is some wrong interpretation of what the state of Europe actually is. So,
I mean,
again, not to sound like a total sort of like lefty, oh, it's the Russians, but that is a certain, there's a certain point here about this being very real.
how much would you say comes from Russia, though, and how much comes from America? And also, I mean, I always think Israel is involved with a lot of these sorts of things too, because there's a
That
vested
might be.
interest to push. I mean, it's just very noticeable that all the populist parties are also hardcore Zionists as well.
Sure, yeah.
So it's like, well, they want to create a Europe that's friendly to
Yeah.
Israel,
Yeah.
something like this. But how much would you say is Russian, and how much would you say is just like US State Department or Trump operatives, or if you had to.
Like as a percentage, it's
Yeah.
hard to tell. I'm going to be conservative here, and I'm sure my co-host would be be even more extreme. I'd say a good half is influenced, not and when I say influenced by outside forces from America, I don't mean that, these are fake people. I mean that these might actually be real people tweeting, but who have been given, an algorithm essentially And the new Twitter X doesn't help with this. I've been given an algorithm that's designed to make them or to have them end up at that conclusion. So where you draw that line is essentially meaningless to me, because it's all slop all the way down.
What makes it extra specially confusing as well is that there was a large Russian attempt to influence the American right. There's a kind of weird convergence between MAGA and like Russian talking points as
Exactly,
well.
yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm talking
So.
about, essentially. Yeah. So I don't want to be like rah-rah Russia on all of this, because there are legitimate criticism of Europe, and I'm sure there are Americans who hold them organically. But for the sort of average Twitter commentator, whenever you talk about Europe, who starts going on about bottle caps, etc., it's they don't know what they're talking about, essentially. And that's not to say that, again, Europe has their own problems, but those problems are a lot less than you believe. And I don't know how to explain that to you, Mr. American, listening to this, but you just have to trust me. There are places we are lagging behind, and I think AI is one of them. For example, I see AI as essentially, like a NASA space race kind of thing. Just between China and the US, and everyone always says that, well, AI is privately financed, but I don't think I have to explain to you, of all people, that I think, the US has a very clear imperative, strategic imperative, in AI versus China. And so, Microsoft might be a private company, but it certainly has to go ahead from the US state to spend money on AI. And Europe is lagging behind in that regard. But that's not to say that the future Europe is going to be isolated. I think it's okay to have allies, as you said. It's okay to do to do geopolitics. But we're certainly now with Trump in a situation where some people are saying, oh, it's all a show. The bonds are still as strong as ever. I think that's broadly Brian Berletic's take. I'm not so sure about that, because I think what a lot of people in Europe are thinking now is that, okay, sure, Trump is one thing, but is this just an American problem? Who's the next president, and who's the president after that? And is he going to be just as unreliable, but he's going to be a Democrat, right? And so what does it matter, really? Essentially, with friends like these, who needs enemies, right?
But even if the next even if the next president is a Democrat who's completely back on board, how can you deal with such a schizophrenic country?
That's what I mean. Like, it doesn't really matter who the next person is, because the person after that might be totally opposite again. And then it's like, okay, it's kind of the same issue we really do. I'm going to simplify this very much. It's way more complex than that, but it's certainly a problem we do have with Russia, right? People are saying, I've seen takes that, Russia for a long time has wanted to be a part of the EU, wants to be a part of NATO. And I certainly believe broadly the Russians or Putin, when he said that, he'd like to be a part of these geopolitical institutions, and that there at some point have been ideas for, diplomatic relations. The problem is that the way Russians have acted with regards to sort of basic day-to-day diplomacy has burned so many bridges over the years, right? You have essentially a generation of people in the various state apparatuses all over Europe. For example, I was talking to someone who worked in the north, in sort of the Arctic Circle diplomacy board. I forget what it's called. You have people who have worked in these institutions their entire career, courting the Russians through various crises, and every time they feel like they get snubbed, because just the way the Russians are, like their character is different from us. The way we make deals is not the same way they make deals. The way we care about deals is not the same way they care about deals. And I'm not saying this to be mean to Russians. I'm just saying we're different. And at some point, and again, this is probably Ukraine. When Ukraine happens, and the Russians then again sort of like sweep the legs of every state apparatus that's been trying to establish diplomatic relations with them, they suddenly just, all the bureaucrats kind of just go, well, okay, so we're just going to give up. Screw you, right? We've tried for like 30 years to have a relation with you guys. We don't want to do it anymore. And until you get a new generation of people who are willing to essentially have peace with Russia, I think you're going to meet a lot of resistance from the European systems.
Interesting. All right, Walrus, well, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on YouTube. You can search for at A Walrus or at Walrus in a Suit on Twitter. We also have our weekly show every Thursday at 8, the Longhouse. You can check us out there.
I'll just remind people, pick up courses at the Academic Agency, Trivium, the bestseller there. Most importantly of all, get out. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.